Welcome, Archetypal Tarot Podcast listeners. This is your host, Sundarak Quackenbush, and I have the immense joy and privilege of welcoming my good friend and amazing artist, photographer, Rachel Phillips, to the show. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Sundarak. Thank you so much. This is so fun to be doing this with you, my dear friend.
Oh, great to see you and to explore your work from this perspective. And I think a lot of our audience members will really enjoy the images and play and curiosities and knowledge that you bring within your work.
Oh, thank you, Sundarak.
And we're celebrating quite a milestone. You basically have this body of work for the past 10 years. You recently celebrated it with a show in Holding Time, Tracing Light down at San Diego State University Art Galleries in collaborations with their archivals and collections. So congratulations on 10 years of amazing work. I can't wait to talk about it with you.
Thanks, Sundarak. I think that there's all different modes of creative people. I have friends that are so driven to be in the studio making work, and they're up at 5 every morning to have studio time before they go to their day job. And I've never been that kind of artist. You and I are both generalists. We're interested in so many things, and I'm so easily distracted, and I love to sew, and I love to garden, or I could just go for a walk. There's so many things, really, any excuse that I can find to not be in the studio making work. So I think a lot of us are very self-critical, and I definitely have a little sort of narrative in my own head of feeling like, gosh, I have more free time, more time I could dedicate to art than so many people that I know that seem so much more productive. So it was really nice to look back after 10 years and say, wow, working at the distracted pace that felt right to me. Nevertheless, over a decade, the work really built up. And so it was such a privilege to have the opportunity to get to show so many different things I've made over the years all together in one space.
Absolutely. And I actually had to make a little list of all the things that, after seeing your show, I realized that you embody in different ways, even if it's just a little touch here or a mirage there. you're an artist, you're a photographer, you're a poet, you're a novelist, you're a filmmaker, archive, theater maker, architect, storyteller, critic, comedian, historian, librarian, and all through all of this, a visionary and an educator to us all, particularly of, I believe, women in these fields, and highlighting both their work through the ages, their presence through the ages, and their absence. So I think that that's a really interesting subject for as we come up on Women's History Month here in March, and just as we continue forth as women in artistic realms, what that means and where we've been, what we've done, and where we're going. So through all of those things, you've created little alter egos, which, I think I need to do this. I've got so many things going on. boy, what a great idea to give a name to, the different aspects of your work, these little alter ego creators. So one of them is Madge Cameron, and she's a librarian and archivist, and this she's seen through your series called Fixed. Tell us about Madge Cameron.
Yeah, I think this also kind of goes back to different ways of being an artist, and I don't necessarily sort of like the brand of being Rachel Phillips, the artist. Thing. A lot of my work is about what's visible and what's not. You just touched on that in terms of the history of women in the arts. And so I really like making work as alter egos because it just allows me to hide myself in the work by hiding behind a fictional person. And there's a freedom in that. There's a freedom and a liberation in that anonymity. Instead of me, Rachel Phillips, being judged or having to vouch for the thing that I've made, I was like, well, it's Madge Cameron. Talk to her. Oh, she didn't pick up the phone, huh? So I had an artist residency in San Francisco maybe about 12 years ago. And for that, I proposed to do a fake group show. So I invented a collective of artists. It was called the Phantom Artists League. And I called myself Rachel Phillips, the curator. And the end of the residency was an exhibition of about 8 different artists who were all me. And some of the artists and some of the biographies and some of the stories resonated more than others. So most of the fictional artists that were invented for that show didn't survive past that show. But Madge Cameron was one of probably my favorite. She was one of the characters in that show that I really fell in love with and have just continued to work with over the years. Her name comes from a really famous pioneering early woman photographer named Julia Margaret Cameron, whose name might be familiar, but her pictures will be familiar to anyone. We all know her. Like, she was an amazing portraitist. So I wanted to kind of, having alter egos, particularly who are women, are just kind of another way of getting a few more names of women into the history of photography, even if they aren't real. There's such tremendous gender inequality today and historically. And work is being done by scholars and curators to really correct that record and go back and find the work of women and insert it into the history books. And I guess I'm too lazy for that. I'm just inventing fictional women and inserting them into my history, which is much easier. Yeah.
Nice.
That's to be fun.
Yeah, that is, that's a way to do it. Why not? So Madge Cameron, she's, I'm imagining her, she's playing, you know, she's maybe she's even doing some like really boring work. I don't know. And you know, maybe she, her project is just like, she has to do a scan of a thousand photographs. Right. And then she gets in touch with the people of long ago. She's seeing their images. But it's still, it's long, it's hard work. And then something happens where the photograph slips, and then this wild, rainbow, colorful, three-dimensional effect takes place. And I actually have one of your little scarves.
Yeah, that looks amazing.
And I always thought they looked really cool, but it wasn't until I saw the show in San Diego and I put on the three-dimensional glasses that they really do pop out. So that's kind of my imagined reality, Madge Cameron. But what is the story of this, of these sort of mistake or failed scans, as you call them?
Yeah, it's all those things you just described, Sindera. It's sort of the ghost in the machine. And Madge is this archivist. It's just, as you said, I envisioned her as archives all over the world are doing. And more so 10 years ago or more, when I started making this work for her, there was just a lot of hand-wringing about the digital revolution in photography. And it was really kind of bridging the end of the analog era of photography. And so these analog objects needed to be digitized, and it's a huge process for institutions all over the world, and it's ongoing and will be forever. And as you said, it's like tedious and mechanical and should be straightforward, but I imagine Madge is this aging archivist herself, a product of the analog world, but she's hip and she cares a lot. And so she's trying to sort of adapt to the times and use these newfangled technologies to do what needs to be done, but it isn't working for her. And these strange and mysterious effects are emerging as she's trying to just make a faithful copy that is a true digital representation of the original. And she finds herself in this kind of quandary, because at first she's just mad because it just feels like failed work. It feels like something that's wrong. But then she starts to feel that these digital scans in and of themselves are something of value that might need to be preserved. And then she's like in this kind of circular muddle. And it's interesting how at different times over the last 10 years, this work that has this digital component, the series is called Fixed, and it's photographs that are broken. Now, when I look at it through the lens of everything that's going on with AI and these image generators and computers rendering, totally, we call them photographs, but they're really not. They're computers that are making illustrations based on these massive indexes of photographs that we've fed into the machine. And the implication for that when you can't, we're in a visual era that post-truth. and the breaks in truth and Madge's work are very obvious. There's those seams of color that are ripping through. There are these very clear digital artifacts that we would recognize. But these new technologies are doing versions of that in a way that's really seamless. And that's kind of fascinating to think about. So it's about technology, but in a deeper sense, it's kind of about the digital world that we find ourselves living in, and which is imbued with a lot of meaning and magic and dark magic that we don't necessarily recognize, for better and for worse, I think, and which is just more and more so. You and I are old enough to have grown up in like a pretty analog world, but kids these days, it's just more and more and more the space where we're living our lives. So we can use Madge, the character of Madge, to kind of have a little bit of safe distance to think about what that'd be like, and also empathize and think, oh gosh, that's going to be me and not too long. Like, I'm keeping up now, okay, with technology. I use emojis, but it won't be too long before we'll all be like Madge. You know, these young kids are going to be saying, oh gosh, don't you know how to do this basic thing? And it's going to seem totally mysterious and incomprehensible to us.
Wow. Yeah, and this really opens a portal into who these people are that we're that you capture, that we're thinking about the future as we look at them as they break apart into these rainbow three dimensions. But holding the pictures themselves, what inspired you to work with these photographs, and what is your relationship to these people that you started to see before you as you created this artwork?
Yeah, I mean, you know me well. I'm a horribly grumpy introvert in the real world. And I love portrait photography. Snapshots are pictures of people, but maybe not portraits. But I myself am not a portrait photographer and don't want to be. I'd have to interact with people. And so at the same time, there's an incredible potency that's really the ability of photography to kind of extract a moment from the flow of time and preserve it. I think that's, it's absolutely at its most vivid and poignant to us when that moment is a person who will never be that person again in the moment of that photograph. Like, even in that part of a second when the shutter is clicking, like by the time that 60th of a second is gone, that imprint on the film then or digital sensor now, like that moment and that person will never be again. And so there is a tremendous sense of history and connection, I feel like, and poignancy, especially in collecting snapshots from eBay or antique stores or paper fairs. Like, these are people that have been discarded, right? Their stories have been lost to history, and this photograph, this momentary image, is what remains. And I think a lot of my work is about doing some kind of intervention that's just enough to kind of cause us to stop and consider that person again. I feel like everything that I do is a small intervention, but the real potency is the history and the depiction of the person that was there. You kind of can't rival that. So I just try to amplify it a little bit. Yeah, it's an incredible thing. And then I think there's a vein of nostalgia in my work. I know there is. And I just kind of try to cut through that by saying, well, to offset that, like, every single person that you're looking at in this show is dead now. Those adorable babies, oh, they're dead. That cute young married couple, oh, they're dead. That old grandpa, oh, he's dead. The dog next to him, dead. So there's that, like, that's sobering, which I think is good. We need to stop and reflect on those things. It's our own history, our future history for all of us.
And there's a really special place where this work comes into play that I think our audience would really enjoy, which is the work of the divinations. And so in this little book and art piece collection of artworks. They're made from, what are they called? They're called portrait cards?
Yeah, they're called cabinet cards. They're from the late 1800s. They're what, maybe like 4 by 6 inches or so. And they're portraits that would have been mounted on a kind of fancy cardboard stiff mount. And this was, you know, from a time within the lifetime of these people, photography came into existence. And prior to that, unless you were wealthy and could have a painting made of yourself, like, people didn't have representations of themselves, like even as a portrait hanging in their home, let alone something that you could send in the mail, send home to your mom, send to your sweetheart. That, like, we forget, as we've all just been photographed ubiquitously our entire lives. Like, imagine how profound that was. So this was a big, and Victorian culture was a lot about trading, think of visiting cards and things. So people would have these portraits made and you would prop it up in the cabinet of your parlor, which is where cabinet card comes from, but also distribute them to people that you knew and your family, and they're beautiful artifacts.
And so you do this unique process called, what is it?
It's, I'll just call it a transfer printing process.
So what is that exactly? How do you, so these are.
It's magic.
Evident card. I'm trying to get beyond the mistake here. But so you're really playful with the different kind of shadow play over, or an imagery over the portraits. And each one is a special different type of divination. So this one was the divination by sharp objects. And so, yeah, how does a transfer print work, first of all?
Yeah, it's something I've been doing for a long time before I came to this work. And it's a specially coated film. Its industrial application is sort of for like big backlit signs, like at a bus stop advertisement for Gap, you know, with a light behind it. And so I get those big rolls of film and I cut them down and I decide what imagery I want to layer on top of these original 100 plus year old photographs. And I usually make a little digital mock-up to kind of figure out how all the elements are going to align. And then I print out the imagery that I'm adding on this special film. And then it's a wet transfer process. So it's a kind of a mixture of isopropyl alcohol and acrylic gel medium and some other stuff. You brush this goop onto this 100-year-old photograph. And then very carefully in registration while it's still wet, I lay down the transfer film. And then, like, mustering all the precision of my Montessori preschool background, you very carefully and patiently and precisely, while holding your breath, like, peel off the film. And then the ink has been transferred onto the photograph when everything goes well.
And do you kind of hold your breath? You're working with this old thing.
Totally. And I have so many that I've ruined, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's the way it goes, right? My dad.
Yeah.
You know, to slice through the stone and find particular images with his work. And, you know, he would be like, oh, it just could look a little bit more like a person. And he would grind down a little more, and then the image would just disappear into nothingness. So that, you know, but I'm kind of imagining those, maybe some interesting ones that were like divination by total mess up or something.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I have stacks of all that stuff. They're like pushed in the back of flat file drawers and things. There's always like, you can't get rid of it. The stacks of failures. So there's always this idea, like, what is this going to become in the future? Which they never really do, or so far they haven't. But yeah, maybe someday they can be dramatically reimagined.
Like the bloopers version of art. Like, we never
get totally
art bloopers. Like, that needs to be a show.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so why divinations, or tell me about like what rabbit hole you went down to do these cards as divinations?
Yeah, so it goes back again to, I think, the connection between photography and time, and thinking of tarot and sort of fortune telling. Divinations, I guess, is sort of a fancy word for fortune telling, and tarot and palmistry and, you know, many, many other things would be in that umbrella. And it's like, our inability to exist in the present. We want to know about the future and we want to know about the past. And it's like, I love history. I loved history growing up. And as I started collecting these photographs, and because they're quite old, they're from mostly the late 1800s, like sometimes there's a name written on the back, oftentimes not. And so there's such a visual presence to these people, but the context and the story and even their name, I just started realizing how much it was impossible to ever know or recover about these photographs. And I thought, wow, like we have that crystal ball and we're always trying to look into the future. We think that we know the past. It's something we study in school. We have heavy history books. We memorize dates. But if you weren't involved in a war, if you weren't a president, if you weren't an astronaut, if you weren't a horrible dictator, then your name and your history isn't recorded. And in a few generations, it's lost, despite the fact a photograph of you can still be surviving. So I really thought, let's take that crystal ball and kind of turn it toward the past, which is kind of my homage, like my loving nod to these people while fully recognizing that that crystal ball is entirely cloudy. There's no real way to divine the path aside from our own human, empathetic, intuitive connection to these people. So that's where it came from.
It definitely makes one want to print out some of your pictures, you know, and try and do it high quality, because so many of our photographs live in the clouds and
totally
on our phones, that, you know, be like, was there good photos on there?
Right. Lost it. Those two vacations. Oh, wow.
And then, you know, once you're gone, who cares? It's not printed out, you know. So but let's say there was a photograph of you, and it's like 100 years in the future. How would you imagine? What would you want people to think of, or if it's say there's no name on your picture, like what would you imagine in the future we could be doing with these kinds of photographs, or what would you want people to be thinking, doing, feeling?
Yes, I'm dodging that question, Sundara. The first part of it I think about a lot, and I really grieve because I'm a huge collector of paper ephemera, including photographs. And it makes me so sad to think that that archive of material isn't going to exist in the future. We are absolutely not making it anymore. And the life cycle of digital photographs is going to be so finite compared to these pieces of paper that are super sturdy and so robust 100 years on. You know, you think of like, yeah, we can't access those first photographs from our first flip phones that were less than 20 years ago. Like the notion, we talk about the cloud, it's such a brilliant euphemism, but the notion that these digital files are going to survive is just completely fallacious. And we're not going to be at a flea market digging through old dead iPhones. Like there isn't going to be any way to recover them. So I think about that, the kind of impossibility of your question for the future. But then I also think, like for myself, there has to be, you have to give yourself a certain amount of freedom when you're working with these materials. And I'm like, well, they're dead. They wouldn't mind whatever thing I might be doing, or the one I messed up on. Like I make a lot of work on old envelopes that have some beautiful handwriting. It's like, oh, ruined that thing, but survived for 100 years until I came along one day and decided to be an artist. So I also kind of think like, for me, for whatever might survive of me in the future, I'm willing to just surrender that to whatever, in whatever form and whatever thing might be happening. It's kind of like trying to imagine we would have control or need control. And I'm hoping these people of 100 years ago were more like, feel the same way about me. They're like, yeah, we're dead. We're fine with that. Whatever thing she's doing with us.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've interviewed two other decks actually not too long ago, the Rosebud Tarot and the Beloved Dead Oracle deck, and they both use, you know, take liberties with old photographs, people that they don't know who they are. They're somebody's ancestor, someone's relative, yeah. But they show up with new life for the viewer, and they're still alive through these images in that way, which I think is really, really special. But it's interesting to hear you talk about this. It almost feels like we're coming full circle with almost going back to a time when before there was printed imagery. It was so rare to have a printed picture back then.
Totally.
And now it's kind of like, it's so rare to have a printed picture. So I don't know, maybe in some weird ways, we're like coming around the spiral or something. I don't know.
It's true. I think we are. I was ordering some little plastic photo albums on Amazon to organize. I just have this kind of out of control boxes of snapshots right now. And I love, when this is a tangent we aren't going to get into, but I love reading reviews of things, like reviews of recipes or reviews of Amazon products. I'm just always so curious about that forum. And it was fascinating reading the reviews of these little 4x6 plastic sleeves for snapshots, and the people lamenting, these are so great. I make them for my grandkids every year. I can't buy them locally anymore. I'm so glad Amazon still has them. It's just like the availability of the materials. It's not something we do. We don't send a roll of film out to the drugstore and get our, duplicate sets of 4x6s back. And so it's, we don't realize, we're just so immersed in the new thing. We don't realize how quickly the other thing has gone away.
Yeah, no, I had that experience, somewhat recently over the holidays, trying to print pictures for family.
It's a pain.
I think I downloaded an app. I was doing it through, it was either Walgreens or CVS. So I was like, where can I just get, they didn't take my payment details, which I should have found suspicious. And then they were never printed. There was no record of me even ordering these photos. I was like, where did they go?
Yeah.
Like, I was like, it's really very hard to get, it seems like it's hard to get pictures printed,
Totally. And it's like, thinking back to those people, I think there's a real tension there that's beautiful between a photograph, which is so specific of a specific person, and there's all that particular individuality. But then past a certain point, in my mind, they really become archetypes of humanity. And there's a tension there, a tension between the particular and the universal. Like, I'm not someone who's ever really been particularly interested in genealogy, say, or tracing the own root of my ancestors, because it feels so specific, and interested in that general thing. But think about, I think what we take pictures of has shifted so much from when we had a roll of film, 36 shots, and like, think of a mom. It was birthday, it was groupings of people sharing significant moments for the most part. And now we're taking pictures of our meals. We're taking pictures of sunsets. We're taking pictures of pretty flowers. Like, I look at my phone and I take so few photographs of people, yet those are the things that those are the pictures I probably want. Mm-hmm. So it's overwhelming just trying to look through our stream of useless photos and trying to think, like, what are the 36 that I would print? Right. But if we can make the app work, I think that our mode of taking pictures and what we photograph has changed so much.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. Just getting to the point of trying to order those photos was overwhelming because, oh my gosh, so much to swim through, to sift through.
Totally.
So how wonderful that this work kind of allows us to imagine into a slightly slower, simpler time.
Yeah.
Where an image was valued and treasured. And speaking of just kind of the vanishing, let's move on to your other alter ego, Frances Paine, in your Vanishing Point series. So I went to, your show in San Diego, and there's these frames of frames. All of them. They look really cool. And then, in reading about them, it was all about, this play on kind of the lost work of female photographers, either that weren't recognized or were never able to be in the first place because of a lack of support, perhaps, and in the world still now, but especially in the past as well. So tell us about Frances Paine and her story.
Yeah, that's it, Sundara. And it started out with thinking of kind of maybe the particular and the universal again. It started out as this much more specific envisioning. She was in this group show, and the story sort of went that she was kind of known to be this brilliant photographer. And I was thinking back to, remember art history classes that you take in college, and they would talk about masterpieces that had maybe been destroyed in World War II or something. And like, maybe there would have been a black and white photograph of the painting, but the church was bombed, like the painting no longer exists. And we just have this kind of bad depiction of it, but it's known. it exists and is known as being significant within the history of art, even though it's gone. So I kind of took that idea and went a step further with it of thinking like, what if there was this woman photographer, Frances Paine, and she was like known and respected at the time, and we know that her work was significant and important. But unfortunately, like through trials and travails of time, like all of her works have been lost. And so the pieces are pictures of the empty frame within the frame itself. But then kind of looking at that work now after 10 years and looking at it within the context of my other work, I realized in a more universal sense, it's really about how do you represent absence, like more broadly, and the paradox of that? Mm-hmm. Nothing is still something, or if it's something, is it really nothing? Like if you have a picture of an empty frame that you've put in a frame, it has a picture in it, but the picture in it is showing the thing empty. So is there a picture in the frame, or is it an empty frame?
Right.
And that kind of circular thinking, which is maybe kind of funny and silly on the one hand, but sort of profound on the other hand, in terms of photography and then our own human experience and memory and the sort of intersection of all of that. Like a memory is not real, it's so ephemeral, but it's important and it links us to something that was real in its time. So the work I was less interested in the specific story I'd invented originally and thought of could see kind of broader themes. And also, the frame is so real and it's there on the wall and all its three-dimensional glory, and the photograph is such a flat sort of pale facsimile of the object itself. And I thought that was interesting too, just to kind of call out that these representations of things aren't the thing itself and don't always approximate it that well. We forget that because we live more and more and more in the world of representation. But the real thing is important. It has a different presence.
Yeah, it makes me think of two things. This is not a pipe. What was that?
Totally.
And then it also reminds me of something. I think it was Virginia Woolf had written about the female Shakespeare, like that she's not known. She has no name. But that she either existed or could have existed in the right contexts. And so I just, I love, that was a very profound reflection in the frames that was felt thanks to Frances Paine.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I want to bring attention here. We have the little theaters that you make. So we can see. If I put it on too bright, you can't really see it in the video, but I'll put it.
Nice.
I gotta put it. My husband helped me put it on a dimmer, so. And then it was so fun to see your show. You made a big life-size one with some film in it and your words coming through. It's just really delightful, but tell us about the inspiration behind these little magic light theaters.
Yeah, it's specific. I grew up going to a theater called the Sanford Theater in Palo Alto that is a beautiful movie palace that was built in the 1920s and restored by one of the Packard sons by money that flowed from HP. into a foundation. And then one of the sons is one, the daughter funded the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which is amazing. It's fascinating to think of these two siblings being so different. The other wanted to restore this movie palace and show classic films from Hollywood's golden age. And so I grew up going there a lot with my parents. That was kind of, we had a small black and white television. They were kind of these progressive hippie types. Like, I was kept away from a lot of mainstream entertainment. So this was a just really impactful childhood memory, both seeing these films in that context, but then also, I think, like a family memory. So I love the architecture. I love the sort of Art Deco aesthetic. And then I just really, in making my own work, I started thinking more and more kind of about the links between still photography and film, and like, where is that little moment of movement that suddenly makes it a film and not a photograph? And then I also, I was really impacted. It's funny, sometimes these books we read as teenagers, the few that really get into our hearts, I think, in those indelible years. And I was really impacted by the Berlin Stories, which Cabaret is based on one of them. And there's a great line in that book that kind of talks about pictures having their own life. And I loved that idea, like what goes on in that camera, that light tight box that we can't see into. Like, by definition, we can't see into it. It has to be completely sealed from the outside world, devoid of light. And pictures are going into that box somehow and being recorded in some way. And I just really started thinking, like, what if they have their own life in there and doing their own thing and entirely changing and like coming up with their own narrative outside of our intention of pointing the camera at that thing and taking a picture of it. So that kind of became the narrative thread of the work that I made to put into these little theaters, was pictures telling their own story, or having permission to be enigmatic and not a saying, this is a picture of XYZ, but right. Pictures revealing themselves.
Yeah, I just love the playfulness and and how they grow in their mystery, and it was fun to interact with it in person, you know, with shadows, and you could kind of go up to these people and be at the beach with them, and you know, all kinds of different things. So much fun. And I love my little theater here at home. So yeah, and you would talk about the narrative thread, and you have one last alter ego that I know of called Tabitha Misty, and she's the intrepid girl photographer. She's got those mystery novels. Tell us a bit about those before we say goodbye tonight.
Yeah, that's a bit ridiculous. Alter egos that then have their own alter egos is like maybe taking it a little far, or maybe just far enough. I think that's probably my most overtly feminist work. And I really wanted to make work that was delivering a message without being preachy. No one likes shrill, finger wagging feminist art. And that's such a like very unfortunate and unfair cliche, but it is what it is. And like that knee jerk audience reaction is what it is. And so I felt like I wanted to make work that was fun and played with the tropes and language and history of photography, but embedded within that, this is another way of kind of inserting more women into the history of photography. So women are so much objectified in photography. They're the muse, they're the subject, they're the nude in front of the camera, but there aren't nearly as many women photographers who have been, like, the photographer is the person with power in that scenario. And so I wanted to invent this historical imaginary woman photographer, Tabitha Misty, and then have her kind of telling her story. And it's a little unclear. It's fiction, but it's probably based on her life, but we don't totally know. If you imagine like a little bit of a celebrity biography type of a thing. So she's writing this series of novels about intrepid girl photographer, which is kind of her, but a fictionalized version of her. And so I collected these old Agatha Christie paperbacks. I love Agatha Christie. I love Miss Marple. I think she's such an amazing character. The definition of the sneak attack. I just love the idea of this kind, plain looking little old lady knitting away that no one would think anything of and would entirely overlook. But she's this incredibly powerful and impactful person who can exert tremendous force on her world. So, and then written by amazing woman author. So I collected these vintage Agatha Christie paperbacks and then made my own covers of Intrepid Girl Photographer books, which turned out when I bought them, I assumed they were all the same size. And then it turns out they're all subtly different. So this becomes this own like project of insanity of custom fitting these like fake covers to all these slightly differently sized like historical paperbacks from the 50s and 60s. And like, you have a little moment out of body experience of being like, how, why? Step by step, how did you get yourself to this insane place, Rachel? But that work is really fun because there's so much vocabulary within photography that can be made to be like a double entendre or suggestive or sort of titular or funny in some way. But within that, I also felt like it was important to point out the male gaze and how much of that history is from a male perspective. And thinking of like if James Bond had been a photographer and a woman, and like what the series had been written about her, and that's Intrepid Girl.
Well, I stepping into your work over the past 10 years, all of it together, I felt invited in. In a way that I don't often feel in gallery spaces or museum spaces where you're kind of like, I'm the viewer, that's the thing. I felt welcomed and interactive and playful with every piece of it. So it was just like, oh, here, this is inviting you to imagine a story. And this one's, you can play with your shadows. And this one, you can put on some glasses and see them pop out at you. It just all felt very playful and interactive. So, and to me, that feels like such a feminine strength in art, is that it wants to be in community, it wants to be in engagement even more. So I love that, and thank you so much for this beautiful work.
Thank you, Sandara, and thank you so much. You win the award for traveling greatest distance to see my exhibition, and I'm so grateful.
I'm so glad I didn't miss it in its final hours. But your work is ongoing. Where can people find you here in 2024?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I haven't gotten there yet in terms of work being out in the world. I'm still trying to resign myself to all of the work in that big show coming back to my studio and looking around. I was like, it was all stored in here before, but where?
And now I have this big theater to bring.
Yeah, and now I have this big theater. So I'm still in a mental place of getting it back before sort of thinking of where it might go out again. But I have a lot lives on my website, which is treadwellpress.com. Another maybe kind of hiding of myself behind another entity. And so I think haven't committed yet in my own mind, but I'm wanting to start sort of twice weekly Madge Cameron posts. I think Madge needs a blog for 2024.
Nice.
So that can be something that lives in our digital realm.
That
work in the physical world.
And thank you so much for sharing all of these behind the curtain details on this digital, you know, podcast video. So so we'll see you in your next manifestations.
Oh, thank you, Sandara.
It was lovely to chat with you, and be well.
Thanks. You too. Bye.